Welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 15th of January 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at radioalbion.com because we have with us a special guest who is standing in for Dennis Wise. We have Horace with us from BitChute. Horace, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me on again. It's such an interesting topic, so looking forward to getting into it more. And once again, I hear that Dennis may well be on the mend now, so that's really good news.
He is. And I was just about to let the listeners know this good news as well. As you just said there, Dennis is on the mend. He's recovering from his operation right now. He said to thank everybody for his prayers, and he said that he will be back like the Terminator. In actual fact, we're hoping that he will be back when we finish doing this Culture of Critique series, which will probably be about another 3 or 4 episodes, and Horace might need a couple of weeks off to do a couple of other streams. So we're guessing in about 6 weeks' time, we are hoping to have Dennis back, and he seemed very cheerful when he was just chatting to me then. So yeah, great news in actual fact. That's really, really cheered me up tonight. And we're going to get into Culture of Critique again tonight. This is the second episode that we've done on this, and it just really struck me today as I was looking through it. It is such a good book. I really do recommend people, if they haven't already, to have a read of Kevin MacDonald's Culture of Critique. It's absolutely fascinating. And as I was looking at it today, it really struck me how so much of it actually bears out what Dr. E. Michael Jones says. I mean, it doesn't just bear out the group evolutionary strategy and evolutionary psychology that Kevin MacDonald is interested in, but it also shows so much of what E. Michael Jones talks about, and it's proof for E. Michael Jones' theories as well. And in particular, this first quote that I pulled out to start with today, this is from Culture of Critique, and it's about Theodore Adorno. Adorno adopted the idea that the basic role of philosophy is the negative role of resisting attempts to endow the world with any universality, objectivity, or totality. That is, with a single organizing principle for society that would homogenize society because it applied to all humans. And just think about that. What that is saying is, he thought the role of philosophy was to negate anything that was going against order and going against objective truth, basically going against logos. And this is exactly what E. Michael Jones talks about. And this is a leading light in social sciences and philosophy. Adorno practically shaped the whole of social sciences with the Frankfurt Institute. And here he is saying that the role of philosophy is to negate objective truth and order. I just find that incredible. What do you make of this, Horace?
Well, it looks like he got his way. I mean, we're living in a time where those things are scorned, right? You know, you quite frequently hear generally quite uninformed people say, what is normal, though? You know, and so on and so on. That is in the spirit of what Adorno's saying there. So, he did well.
Well, you think about, you know, objective beauty. And that is objective. It's not subjective. It's based on whether something is symmetrical. It's based on the golden mean. It's based on proportion. And we're told today, oh no, beauty is, you know, it can be anything. It can be incredibly fat. It can be incredibly ugly. You're being fattest if you're not saying it's beautiful to be obese. It's absolutely incredible how far we have gone with this idea of just critiquing everything. I've got more quotes that we can get into later on specifically about this, but maybe we should start with just pointing out some of the things that have been critiqued since this happened, which I guess we could say we were saying about 70 years ago after the war. This really happened with the Frankfurt School when they moved into America. And the first one I've got here is just the critique of traditional morality and the promotion of homosexuality. And this takes in so much. It takes in the critique of the nuclear family, saying that that's old-fashioned, that's oppression of women, so you end up with single mothers. And then they're told that they should be having careers and they shouldn't be serving their husband and they should be playing the field. It's wrong for them to stick with one man. So then you have the free sex. So that does away with the idea of saving yourself for your husband. And then, of course, the obvious product of the free sex is unwanted children. So then you have the promotion of abortion, because everything is then based around the self. And if the woman doesn't want to have a child, why should she have a child? It's her body. Why shouldn't she just kill the child? So we do away with all this basic morality just through criticizing everything, and we end up with instead of holding up paragons of virtue and celibacy and women that have raised lots of children, we end up with the promotion of homosexuals and patting them on the back and saying how brave and courageous they are to be talking about their homosexuality in public. It's like our morals have been completely turned on their heads. I mean, I don't want to be knocking people that unfortunately are homosexual. I mean, I will say I'm fortunate. I'm not going to celebrate them. I think it's a tragedy that they're not going to be able to enjoy the benefits of a heterosexual relationship and being able to produce children of their own. And they're also very, very likely to get disease. They're very, very likely to die young. It's not something that should be promoted. I'm not going to attack the people themselves. I think that they're used in this way. Like all of these subjects we talk about today, they're used to weaken the host society. And of course, that increases the strengths of the people that are actually doing this, that are doing this on purpose. What are your views on this breakdown of our morality and promotion of homosexuality, Horace?
It's something that Kevin MacDonald comments on. I believe it is in Culture of Critique. If not, it's the one before. But he uses the term corrosion, which I thought was especially apt. Yeah, it's sort of an acidic or, you know, corrosive influence that a lot of Jewish philosophers, and Adorno exemplifies it very well. Herbert Marcuse, I think, is another one. Yeah, Adorno particularly, really a leading proponent of this sort of corrosive thinking. Yeah, I mean, when you mentioned like homosexuality in particular, I thought immediately of the Philip Schofield thing from a few months ago, where not only did they celebrate him coming out, I don't think his, you know, revealing himself to be a homo was that surprising to anyone. He's always a slight sort of touch of effeminacy about him, I would say. But not only was it celebrated, but I think this is the correct reading of it, it was also used to disguise the fact that he had been dallying with... Maybe, you know, I'm using a vague word because I don't really know the specifics, but dallying with a man who was so young that there was good reason to suspect that it began before he was of legal age. So, you know, it's also just useful in a cynical way for people who are, I don't know, really, really... it's kind of scornful of the old ways to both get their way ideologically and also to cover their own potentially crimes. I mean, I can't be firm about that, but yeah, I mean, you compare that back to how homosexuality was treated at certain times in history. It was something that, you know, a man who was homosexual might still have a family and children. Now, people will at that point raise legitimate concerns because, of course, I think paedophilia is far more prevalent among homosexuals than anyone else. So, you know, whether homosexuals should be having family and children in their homes and so on, I can understand why there's doubt there. But all the same, there was in the past, and I'm sure it's varied over time, but there's a range of ways for people to, you know, I'm talking about people who are born with that proclivity, to still not be antisocial, as you know. And I would say that the promotion of and the celebration and the parading of homosexuality, that is antisocial. That is corrosive in the sort of way that, I mean, I would imagine Adorno would have celebrated this, although some people would question that, because a lot of people like to point to Adorno having reactionary attitudes towards jazz music. Some people characterize it as racist as well, but I don't think he was racist in other ways, so I think that's a bit of a sloppy characterization. But people say that he was actually very conservative in certain ways, and they've said this of others of the critical theorists. Now, that might be true, but as a philosopher, he was absolutely subversive and, against our society. And Well, just you mentioned as well the Second World War. I would just modify that a bit in that most of the Frankfurt School had moved to America, I think, by the time the Second World War started and established themselves. I think it was the New School in one of the other New York colleges or universities, and Columbia and the University of California, I think. And they had a very willing reception. I think I mentioned this last week. They were invited over, a lot of them. Not all of them made it. I think Walter Benjamin killed himself. He was more of a poet, actually. But anyways, I just think it's significant that they were already doing what they were doing, and they were already welcomed to do what they were doing by the time the Second World War happened. But, of course, Adorno is famous for having said this famous... it's paraphrased, but, you know, there can be no poetry after Auschwitz. And he also used, the F scale, the fascist scale, that obviously refers back to the that obviously makes use of the extremely negative cachet that was around National Socialism and fascism after the Holocaust was supposedly discovered or proclaimed, depending on how you look at it. I believe that the Second World War really sort of elevated their power and influence because it gave a pretext for their supposedly anti-fascist, but what I would say really anti-white, anti-Western and anti-social attitudes. I just think it's significant that they were in place before the Second World War, but the Second World War was immensely helpful to them because it cemented that victor's history of the Nazis as the ultimate evil, the Soviets as a kind of saviour, and obviously the Soviet stories about war atrocities all being taken as fact, which is ludicrous, that was all immensely helpful to them. So they actually gained in power thanks to the decisions of the American ruling class, which was part white, part WASP, part Jewish by that point.
Yeah, sort of gave them shielding from criticism. They said that they were doing this to try and prevent fascism and identify what it was that caused people to grow up and become fascists and national socialists, that they would have had support in that because people have been programmed to see the national socialists and the fascists as carrying out this horrific genocide of the Jews, which is what was promoted to people. And it's interesting that Kevin McDonald looks at some of these accusations that the National Socialists made about the Jews and what was going on in Weimar Germany. And he says, well, they did have a point, and you just have to look at the statistics to see that they had a point in this. And just to go back there to what you were saying about Philip Schofield, the other side to that, as well as the fact that there was the allegations that there was a young boy there that may have been underage when the relationship first started, what about his wife? I mean, we're talking about traditional morality here, and you have somebody that was married to his wife, and I think he has two daughters, and he'd been married to her for about 30 years, and he then suddenly comes out and says, I'm homosexual, and everyone pats him on the back. If that had been a straight man who suddenly came out and said, I've been sleeping with lots of different women over the last 30 years, he would not have been patted on the back for it. But because it was his own gender that he was saying he'd been doing this with, he was suddenly seen as courageous. So homosexuality has actually been raised up above heterosexuality here through this through this critiquing. I don't know if you want to comment on that, Horace.
Well, and I think you characterised it well. I mean, we're essentially celebrating the end of what was probably quite a successful family and home, right? We're actually cheering for that. Well, you and I ain't, but we're being called upon to celebrate what is probably quite a horrible and miserable thing for his wife and children. I mean, I'm speculating, but they're probably under pressure to, say that they celebrated too. But I bet it's not a genuinely happy thing at all. It's just, your father's basically putting his sex life before, the stability of your home.
Well, this fits in.
I can't go into too much detail about it because I don't really know. But we're celebrating the end of a marriage. That's a sad thing.
Yeah, destruction of a family. And this fits in with the quote that I said there at the beginning. They want to resist attempts to endow the world with universality and objectivity. And of course, heterosexuality is universal throughout the entirety of the animal world. So that's something that they would want to critique. That's something that they would want to attack, and they've done that very successfully with traditional morality. Another thing that they've very successfully critiqued is Christianity and the removal of it from schools, with this so-called separation of church and state, which it isn't actually, doesn't actually say that in the Constitution. That is not what was actually meant by it. But what they've succeeded in doing is removing all positive references to Christianity from everywhere, from schools, offices, workplaces, from the government. And yet everything that we had was based upon these Christian laws up until about 150 years ago. When you became a member of government, you had to swear to uphold the Christian laws. And the Jews lobbied the government to change that, because they said, well, we can't join the government. We can't be politicians if we have to swear to uphold Christian law. And at first they couldn't get in, and they kept lobbying whichever party it was that was in power at the time. It took them, I think, 20 years, 30 years, and eventually they managed to get this oath removed. So instead of then having to promote Christian law and everybody taking an oath to promote the morals of the Bible, basically, they managed to get that removed. And as more of them have come in, they've gradually removed as much as they possibly can from society all the references to Christianity. So you don't see nativity scenes now. You see them saying that they don't want to have nativity plays in the schools. You don't see those now. Instead of having proper Christmas carols, we have things like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And instead of saying Merry Christmas, we're supposed to say Happy Holidays. And they say, well, this is because we want to remove religion from the public sphere. But what it's all really about is removing Christianity from there, because they don't like Christianity. Christianity was a uniting thing that united the non-Jews together. And anything which is a single organizing principle for society that is for the non-Jews, they wish to get rid of. And Christianity was probably the most central organizing principle that we had, that we could coalesce around. And that's why, it was a number one target for them, I believe, was to remove Christianity in this way. And they've been extremely successful in doing that. I don't know if you'd like to comment on that at all, Horace.
Yeah, I imagine, as you've sort of described it, I think the pretext in the first place, maybe it was the real reason, but I'm inclined to think it's a pretext for, sort of de-religionizing, de-Christianizing politics and having, you know, prominent crosses and so on in public buildings and so on. I think, to the extent that Jews wanted to, you know, get rid of that, they would have said that, this excludes us and that's not fair. And we know that when Jews set themselves upon lobbying for a certain outcome, they do it with an avidness that I think a lot of whites can barely even comprehend, an acuteness, a sort of calculatedness. And it's very, very impressive, I must say. McDonald's book describes the Jewish lobbying for the end of there's several different stages, but in the story of America's immigration openness and then restrictiveness and then openness and restrictiveness and then openness again, Jewish lobbying was the deciding theme, the deciding factor at least twice. And certainly everyone in our circles would probably know about the Hart-Celler Act in the 1960s. But there was also an earlier episode in the 1910s, I believe, or the decade before, where Jewish lobbying even then, you know, when there was fewer Jews and in less powerful positions, was amazingly effective, basically buying the obedience of key senators or key politicians. But what Christianity, you know, having been, undermined and shoved back and so on, I think we're in a position now where real Christian faith, you're a Christian, right? I believe Dennis is as well. Real Christian faith, which I associate with people like you, not with Justin Welby, are it's treated in much the same way that fascism is, right? Like fascism and nationalism. Would you say that?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So prominent Christian figures that we see now, and it really, and we're living in an absolutely ridiculous time in terms of Christian institutions. Like the Pope I don't really believe that the Pope is genuinely a Christian. I'm not convinced. I mean, he might be. Justin Welby, likewise. I mean, there's a really superficial faith laid over a big, deep pond of left-wing beliefs or anti-Western beliefs. I really believe that is like the vast majority of their thinking. You see some of the most ridiculous leftist proclamations on Twitter that I see it from American preachers, often like Methodists, Episcopalians, and also sort of charismatic black preachers. I think one's called Talbot Swan. Most of what he writes is just anti-white stuff. You know, so he's called Reverend, but he's just preaching against our race for the sake of his, or he thinks for the sake of his. And like Christianity in the hands of a lot of people has become a ludicrous thing where Jesus is literally just a thing that they use, like the, you know, the word Jesus and the sort of the words that have that for a lot of people that have a residual kind of a holiness about them. You know, the name of Jesus is supposed to be a somewhat sacred thing for someone who believes that he was the Son of God and so on. They are using Jesus, I would say cynically, basically just as a way of making people listen to what are in fact just left-wing and anti-white proclamations. And is, you know, Christianity in the sense that it refers to them is in a ridiculous state. But the true faith obviously abides in still in the minds and the hearts of huge numbers of people. It's just that they're now the institutions are led by phonies, I think. I mean, Justin Welby, I just think, is a fake. And the Pope, I think, is a fake.
They would rather read out from the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights than they would actually read out from the Bible. I've seen Justin Welby do that a number of times. But it hasn't just been the removal of Christianity from the public sphere. As you say, it's been the neutering of it as well through the subversion of it, through the conversos, basically. When the conversos became Christians, some of them were pretty much forced to become Christian, or else they were told they had to leave the country in places like Spain and Italy. But then they would join and they would become Christian, and then they would do the exact same thing that we're seeing here. They would critique Christianity, and that was where this really began, was with these conversos, this culture of critique. So what we're seeing in the church and with Christianity is the end result of centuries of doing this very thing. And when we see this morality is turned on its head and homosexuality is now raised up in common society, also within the church now, we see we have homosexual priests, we have transsexual, I'm not sure if it's a baptism, but it's supposed to be similar to a baptism that they actually have for transsexuals now within the Church of England. It's just totally been ruined and pulled apart by all of these critiques and all of this subversion. And I just want to pick up on there as well when you were saying about the lobbying that they did to get the Immigration Act changed in America. I mean, that was decades of work that took. I mean, this shows that this isn't a conspiracy. This is the fact that it's just instinctive with them to compete for their own best interest. And I think back then, 100 years ago, as we talked about last week, we were in the ascendant. We were the leading country. Whites were very, very comfortably at the top in everything throughout the world. And we had this other group with us, these Jews with us, that knew that, and they wanted to compete against us. They wanted to take that role. And they were in a minority. They've always been a minority. They've always had small numbers, but they've always been aware of this. And perhaps we haven't been aware of it because we've been at the top. We haven't been aware that there's this competition between all the races. The Jews have been very well aware of it because they're very well capable. But, you know, I think as we pointed out last week, they are very, very worthy opponents in this, and they want to be there at the top. We've forgotten that, but they hadn't, and they will work all the time to improve their status and increase their ethnocentrism. That's why they were able to get the immigration laws changed. That's why they were able to get these oaths changed. That's why they've had such an effect on our society, is because they see what another Jew is doing and they support him because it is another Jew that is doing that, and because they can see that it's to their benefit, even if it's not to the benefit of the host society. I mean, it really is just this competition that we're in, and white people have forgotten that we're competing, and the Jews are giving us an absolute trouncing because they haven't forgotten, and they're very, very good competitors. you know, you have to admire them for the way that they are so persistent in getting to these positions. You may not admire the techniques that they use and the strategies that they use, because they're not the sort of things that white people would do, but they are the sort of things that Jews would do. And, you know, we have to have competitors, we have to have opponents in life, we have to have this struggle so that we can improve ourselves. And that, you know, that's why I do find them fascinating to study. I really do. I don't know if you want to comment on any of that, Horace.
Yeah, but I agree with what you said. One thing that I find is interesting about it is how much of a difference there is between the influence of Ashkenazi Jews and Sephardis. Because when you mentioned that the intensity of Jewish lobbying for open immigration, especially obviously for immigration that's open to Jewish immigration, that was the case when there was this struggle in the early 20th century, and then the one that resulted in the Hart-Celler Act was, I think, had a different aim, and that was about just trying to get in as much African, Asian, South American immigration as possible. So that was different. But the earlier struggle, I believe it was in the first decade or two of the 20th century, McDonald covers it in great detail, so I recommend people read that bit. But that was specifically to benefit more. So some Jews had already moved into America. I think there'd been Sephardi Jews in America for, I believe, a century or more before that, but a major wave of Ashkenazi immigration from the Russian Empire and other parts of Eastern Europe, that began, and that affected that, you know, moving across towards Western Europe and Britain and majorly into America, that began in sort of the latter half of the 19th century and the early 20th century. I intend to make a video about this at some point. And so this struggle that Jewish lobbying, sort of the Jewish lobby underwent and with some success in the early 20th century, was to ensure that as many more Jews, you know, this was fought by people who'd already got into America. This was to ensure that America remained open to millions more who wanted to come. And as I say, they were successful for a while, but then there was restrictions passed in, I think, the early to mid 1920s. Which then stopped that wave, but many had got in already. That was obviously Ashkenazi people, and I think that the revolutionary spirit that Michael Jones talks about is more evident among them, as far as I can tell. So when I think of Sephardi Jews, the Rothschilds were Sephardis, and they're very, very considerable a family, like the amazing impact upon history. I actually find it hard to gauge because they're one of the less written about of these sort of mega wealthy world families. But I also think of Benjamin Disraeli, who was close friends with Rothschilds. Actually, Benjamin Disraeli does not, as far as I can tell, I've read a biography of his, I've read like bits of his writings. He does not seem to have had any contempt for white people at all. He doesn't seem to have had it. As far as I can tell, didn't seem to have really any subversive tendencies himself. And some people, even among like white nationalists, rate him as one of the better prime ministers that Britain's had. And he was prime minister at a time of sort of general success and expansion for the British Empire. And he seemed to identify with the British Empire whilst thinking of himself still very distinctly as a Jew. And he wrote about the importance of race. Like, so consider how opposite that is to Franz Boas, whose life's work was to deny the importance of race, especially to whites, obviously. Benjamin Disraeli doesn't seem to have had any of that. And there's various other Sephardis who I think bear that out as well. And that's not to say that there's no corrosion or subversion that comes from Sephardis. There definitely is plenty. But the Ashkenazi seem to have that spirit more. And I think Douglas Reed is really interesting about that. I don't know if you've read The Controversy of Zion, but he speaks about... Reed's book doesn't give that many sources, so some of what he says has to be taken as conjecture, but it seems very well-informed conjecture. He talks about how Zionism and communism, and he means Zionism very in a sort of very accusatory way, like he's not just talking about the desire to have a Jewish home, he's talking about, you know, Jewish supremacy. But he talks about Zionism and Marxism as having both emerged about almost exactly the same time. And it's noteworthy that the Balfour Declaration and the Bolshevik Revolution took place in the same year, I think within a few weeks of each other. But he says both those things emerged from the ghettos of Eastern Europe. And he said in those ghettos, there was a contained and intense and fervent atmosphere of, I don't know what you'd call it, like ethnic indoctrination. And certainly the idea of Jews as the chosen people and as the rightful masters of mankind was inculcated and expressed in both those revolutionary tendencies, Marxism and Zionism. And I think that there's traces of that, well, more than traces of that, the continuation of that in Jewish activism through the 20th century. And a lot of what we think of as like the worst elements of Jewish activism are drawn from the Ashkenazi example. So I think the intense sort of cultivation of Jewish supremacy in the ghettos is a very important thing to be aware of. And that took place sort of at the time, or a bit before and at the time and during the time of that massive wave of Jewish immigration from east to west that, you know, has had all the results that we're talking about.
Yeah, they probably may be better at it, the Ashkenazi, but if you go back right to the fall of the temple and you had the Jewish revolution then, the cause of the Judean War that Flavius Josephus writes about, and I always cite that as the first sort of historical instance of Bolshevism. They even starved the peasants there, and people got so starving that they were even eating their own children, and they were dressing up in women's clothes, and absolute debauchery was going on in this rebellion against the Romans, and they could have only been Sephardic Jews. But then, you know, as you say, we end up with people like Disraeli, and maybe he's an exception to the rule, but he still saw himself as primarily Jewish. He still identified with the Jews. It's just he wasn't so subversive as these others. But then we do see in these movements of the 20th century, we do see that they are predominantly Ashkenazi movements rather than Sephardic. So maybe the link between the two is the Talmud, which, as you point out to there, this idea of them being the chosen people, them being chosen to rule. And a lot of the literature of the 19th and the 20th century that was looking into this were saying that it was like a mirror opposite of Christianity, where the Christian nations were sovereign and they were sovereign under God, whereas the Jews saw themselves as being the earthly Messiah, the Jewish race themselves, and that they should have been ruling rather than Christ ruling. And you had this idea of the conspiracy of the Jews to take over the world, and that all fits in with it as well. And it all goes back to the Talmud. So people can say, well, it's their indoctrination from the Talmud, and even these atheist Jews, they had that when they were young. But then what is the Talmud? It's a reflection of their racial soul anyway. That's what their religion is. It came from within them, it came from within their race. It didn't come down out of the sky and say, here you are, follow this. It came from within them. There probably was a spirit, obviously, well, there obviously was, it's a religion, there was a spiritual element to it as well. But it's really that's just them themselves, I think. And maybe there are to different degrees, as you say there, the Sephardic, maybe they're not quite as revolutionary as the Ashkenazi. Certainly haven't been over the last two centuries. But then we don't know about the Muslim side.
I'm sorry, go on.
Well, I was just going to finish up there by saying, but we don't have that much information about how they got on in the Islamic world, whether they started revolutions there or not, we don't know, because they were the mainly Sephardic.
That's a very interesting question, I think. That's something I know hardly anything about as well. I'd like to know more. So anyone who wants to contribute something interesting to read to that, I'd be willing to read that. What you said about, in a way, the revolution, the revolt against the Roman Empire by the Jews of the time, and you likened them to the Bolsheviks in a way. I think it's very significant that people often mention that one of the early acts of the Bolshevik government was a strict and very sincere prohibition against anti-Semitism, right? I think that's one thing that should be mentioned, like coupled with that is... It's really, really horrible. Giles Uddy, in his book Labour and the Gulag, lays this out fairly well. I think it's in that book. That there was also through the 20s and 30s a very severe persecution of Christianity. And I think the Bolsheviks took pleasure in first, they would like ruin the finances of a church because they didn't want to be seen to launch a direct attack on the Christian faith because so many of the people really had it in their hearts. so many of the people that the Bolsheviks relied upon basically for slave labor, essentially. They took pleasure in basically they would levy like impossibly high taxes on something that the church couldn't do without. So they weren't attacking the church, but they in reality they were. Then the priest would effectively have to abandon the church because he couldn't live. Like, he just could not make a living, like, you know, in the normal way. So he basically had to leave the church, and then they would take great pleasure in dynamiting the churches. And one thing that's often undermentioned is that I think tens of thousands, maybe even in the hundreds of thousands of priests were executed in the sort of first few decades of the Soviet Union. So that really does seem like, we know that the Bolshevik regime was Jewish led up to a point. I think it's still significant that Stalin wasn't Jewish, although I think he had some sort of like relationship ties, and a lot of the people closest to him had Jewish wives or were Jews themselves. But it's very much a Jewish inspired government, and yeah, they took great pleasure in basically destroying as much of Christianity in the Russian Empire as they could.
And while they were doing that, they were building synagogues, of course. The synagogues were allowed to flourish. It was just the churches that were pulled down.
I mentioned that Stalin wasn't Jewish, but of course, under Stalin, especially in the Second World War, the two most famous propagandists for the Soviet Union were Ilya Ehrenberg and Vasily Grossman, who were both very like strongly ethnocentric Jews. And much of the radio service was run by Jews as well, and the film industry. So it's all there, even in the 40s.
It's okay if they have this movement and it's run by Jews. It's just if you have a movement that everybody coalesces around and it's non-Jewish, that's where it has to be subvertive. If it's Jews that are running it, then it's perfectly fine for people to flock around it with instances like communism there. I've got another two here that I wanted to bring up. Criticism of art and beauty. And I spoke about this criticism of beauty earlier, where they try and say that it's not objective when it is objective. As I say, it's based on proportion, it's based on symmetry. And what we now have is modern art, which is just ugliness, and it's made its way into architecture. So even the buildings we now make are oppressive, and there's a sense of foreboding in them. And I guess because if they're made symmetrical, if they're made pleasing to the eye, then that's order, isn't it? That's order in the universe. So they will rebel against that because that's universal. You know, things that are beautiful are universally beautiful. Everybody can see that they're beautiful. And as Adorno said at the beginning of this, that they are the enemies to that. That's what their philosophy, that's what their social sciences, that's what everything that's taught in the universities today is about destroying. The National Socialists were very against this modern art. They did everything they could to prevent degenerative art, as they called it, from taking hold. It's a great shame, really, that it's still praised to this day, and people spend lots and lots of money on these hideous things, and we don't really hear about real beautiful art. You know, I love looking at old paintings that depict landscape scenes and the hunt and dogs and very British scenes. I can remember beautiful pictures of art, and then you compare that to what we're told today and what we see at the Tate Modern and these ridiculous things that we're told are actually art. Art is supposed to be about beauty. It's supposed, you express the beauty of the world through the paintbrush or through whatever. It's about expressing beauty. And through the criticism of that, they've even ruined that now. I don't know what your views are on the art world, Horace.
Yeah, from what I know of, say, National Socialist architecture, that was very much a reassertion of what you could say is like Athenian architecture, right, or Greek, Greco-Roman inspired architecture. It was obviously a conscious and deliberate reassertion of, yeah, sort of Athenian principles of, yeah, beauty, symmetry, and grandness in proportion. I mean, like, not grandness for aggrandizement, but, you know, like, making things, I don't know exactly what word, but sort of glorious, or reflecting aspirations. What architecture do we have now? It's just glass and steel, which conceals basically just people moving paper around and trying to make money, which, you know, I'm not an anti-capitalist myself, but there's certainly a lot of ugly things within the, what we call capitalism. And in terms of art, in terms of beauty, or in terms of modern art, I'd refer people to a superb essay. I'm not sure who it was by, but yeah, there's an excellent essay that was on Occidental Observer. I'm not sure if it was Andrew Joyce or another writer. It might be another writer, but I recommend people look it up. It's about Mark Rothko. So if you just search his name on Occidental Observer, you should find it. And I think it was in more than one part. That was very, very illuminating. Like, are you aware of Mark Rothko, Sven?
Yeah, I had to have a look at some of his stuff when I did an open university course. And I can remember thinking then, what is this? Why is this supposed to be any good? I just remember being very confused by it. I think I may have read the Occidental Observer article you're referring to. And yeah, but please continue.
Yeah, I think it was maybe, it was in the last year that, I came across it. I think it might be older than that. But it was very good article. And it was about how Mark Rothko became famous. Kind of answers your question, I think. Basically, not for his talent, but because of his, partly because of his ethnicity. Obviously, he was Jewish himself, but also because he was kind of Marxist leaning, you know, subversive and countercultural and against the existing order. So it fits very, very well with the negative dialectics thing. And also just about beauty. I mean, maybe I'm making a trite point here, but I think that also Jews have an ethnic interest in, diminishing our assertions of the importance of beauty. And I agree with you, beauty is objective. Not that there isn't a subjective element to attraction, but still beauty and fineness, I think fineness is one way of putting it. These are objective things. I mean, like Olivia Wilde is objectively more beautiful than Miriam Margolyes, and not only because of ethnic reasons. I'm not just picking the white woman. She's just a better looking woman. And that is just a fact. And anyone who says it is just talking rubbish. Anyone says it's not true, it's just talking rubbish. But I would say that perhaps Jews have, people might say this is trite, I don't know, but have an ethnic interest in denying beauty because I think there's less, is the term dimorphism, sexual dimorphism or something? There's less variance between Jewish males and females in how they look. There's far more, I mean, you do get masculine, burly, strong, tough Jewish men sometimes, but a great many Jewish men like have a degree of sort of, like effeminacy, not exactly effeminacy, but like just less noticeably manly. And likewise, a lot of Jewish women have a touch of boyishness about their face and tend not to have like elegant or slender feet, figures. You know, they tend to be more kind of just functional bodies. Whereas, you know, among the white race, obviously there are a great number more of us, so we do have an advantage there. But there are many, many examples of people who just are physically magnificent. obviously, less so as they age, but, you know, and I'm not a specimen. I'm just sort of an average looking person. But it just, I think there, you know, if your ethnic group has just very few exemplars of beauty, or, you know, or whatever the male equivalent is, male fineness, then you do have an advantage there. There is an advantage there in denying the importance of those things.
Yeah, they would deny the importance of it to try to make themselves feel better, I guess. I think a lot of it is down to proportion and the correct proportions. And after, when you have mixed race people, that's sometimes why somebody who's mixed race just won't look quite right. And it's because they've got odd proportions, because part of their body will have proportions of somebody who's white and the other part of their body will have proportions for somebody who's black. And you can't quite put your finger on it. But once you know about the different proportions that there are between the races, then you can identify what it is that's causing this jarring feeling. You know, the proportion and symmetry is, and the golden mean as well in particular, and all of those are visually pleasing things. They're all signs of beauty. They all work together towards beauty, and they're all reflective of the order of the universe, again, which the Jews, by their own words, they seek to subvert. The other piece here that I picked out that gets criticized is the military. And this is an incredible thing that we've seen over the last 10 years, where we've actually seen soldiers being taken to court for killing too well in the war. They're being too mean with their killing in Afghanistan. We have to take them to court. Or soldiers that were trying to fight against the IRA, and we're now taking them to court because I don't know why. I mean, how you can take a military man to court for killing when he's engaged in a war, I just don't know. And now people don't want to wear the red poppy. We have all these protests on Remembrance Sunday. We may be critical of our forces for going out there and fighting to essentially advance the causes of Israel, but they're still our military. They're still prepared to lay down their lives for us. It's just the people at the top that are in the wrong. It's the government that are ordering them away on these wars that are in the wrong. The actual military themselves, you know, they're really good people, and they should be able to count on their country to look after them, not to count on their country to take them to court for so-called war crimes, when the biggest war crimes were the government and the terror bombing in the Second World War, not individual soldiers accidentally killing citizens in Afghanistan. I mean, it's very difficult to tell who's a citizen and who's a jihadi when you're in a place like Afghanistan. But this critique of the military, this I think this is the most recent thing that we've had. We can say the critique of beauty, that can come under the critique of art, but the actual taking the military to court for killing and for things to do with the war and critiquing the military, that I think that's really just happened since the millennium. Would you agree with that, or think of any other examples there, Horace?
Yeah, it's something that I've not read a great deal about. I've read some headlines, and I'm aware that obviously it's very, very controversial. I think, which conflict these things happen in is probably of some significance. But then on the other hand, it does seem to be targeting some soldiers from each conflict, if I understand correctly. And is this something that you've seen being sort of led or inspired by Jewish forces, or?
Well, the lawyers. I think they're probably right. Jewish lawyers.
Human rights lawyers.
Yeah, but it's all a part of this culture of critique, isn't it? Where all the institutions have to be critiqued. So now we're on to critiquing the military, and we've got to turn the military homosexual, and they've got to wave rainbow flags, as well as actually criticising them for being a military and for killing people. We've got to take them to court over that. There's been some recent ones where they've taken people to court for fighting against the IRA, and there's been another soldier that they finally dropped the court case. And I think the lawyer that was actually doing this to do with the ones in Iraq, I think he's been found to be crooked as well. I'm not sure of a specific Jewish component to this, but it's a part of this culture of critique, which is why I really wanted to bring it up.
Right, yeah. And obviously, I mean, there's an obvious interest there for anyone who wants to corrode our society in demoralising and creating doubt among soldiers, just as is done in almost every other area of society. And if we can't rely on our soldiers, then civilians will doubt themselves more, because they'll wonder about the security of their society as well. So I can see an obvious interest there, and it absolutely fits with the idea of the culture of critique. Just in terms of the lawyers who are pursuing these things, I mean, I think of human rights lawyers as generally a pretty low-down, grubby bunch of people anyway, and also among the most hypocritical and sanctimonious. I mean, they proclaim themselves as the saviours of all of us, which is absolute tosh. They exist to hurt the good and to serve the bad, and they know it. But and obviously, human rights is itself, I think this is an important thing, I think human rights is itself basically a Jewish concept. And a hypocritical concept, again, as I say. But one of the leading law firms, I think it's a law firm that deals in all sorts of areas, but it's certainly known for its work in, quote, human rights and also anti-extremism, i.e. anti-whiteness now. It's not really particularly concerned with genuine extremists. And that's Mishkan de Raya. I don't know if you've heard of Mishkan de Raya. They're quite a big law firm now, and they are a Jewish firm. I would expect that if you look into these cases, Mishkan de Raya are in amongst the lawyers involved, because they are a really, really malignant organization.
Before we had human rights, we had rights that couldn't be taken away from us. Our rights were given to us by God. As soon as we accepted we had human rights, and they were given to us by government and thought up by the UN, of course they can be applied selectively, or they can be removed, as we see with these coronavirus restrictions. Well, let's have a look at how Theodore Adorno actually describes how Jews see themselves. This is another quote that I thought was particularly interesting. He says, "A happiness without power, wages without work, a home without frontiers, religion without myth. These characteristics are hated by the rulers because the ruled secretly long to possess them. The rulers are only safe as long as the people they rule turn their longed-for goals into hated forms of evil. So he's saying a few things here. He's basically saying this is what the Jews want. Happiness without power, wages without work, a home without frontiers, and religion without myth. That's the way that the Jews see themselves. And they see that because the non-Jews want that for themselves, they're jealous. And instead of working for these goals ourselves, we turn this jealousy into anti-Semitism. And that's their theory of where anti-Semitism comes from. And it really gives us an insight into what they think is good. Wages without work. Open borders for everyone. Of course, open borders for everyone while they retain their networking, while they retain their group. Everybody else loses their group. But the idea of, you know, never having to work for anything. And that just gives us such an insight into the difference between Jews and non-Jews, don't you think?
Yeah, some really sort of fantastical projection upon us as well, right? I mean, I don't really want wages without work. I mean, that seems absurd to me. I mean, I like the idea of a world where we can do just what work we want to, the work that matters to us most. That sounds like some sort of utopia to me. But the idea of being paid without working, that, I mean, wages came about because of the need for work. Wages and work are inseparable, right? I mean, not inseparable, but you don't have wages without work. You could have work without wages. But it's a classic form of Jewish inversion. It's just, and he's projecting that upon us, right? He's saying that we want that and we don't have it, and they do, and we're jealous of them we're envious of them because of that, and that's where our anti-Semitism comes from. Unfortunately, there is a nugget of truth in there. There is white envy of Jews in that, you know, Jews' cooperation with each other makes them strong, and sometimes white people, instead of trying to do the same, just envy them for that bitterly, which is, you know, that really does happen, and people sort of grumpily look at the way they're achieving and we're losing, and, you know, obviously the key thing is to do likewise or do better. I mean, I think we've discussed before, we don't really want to become the Jews, we want to be ourselves, but we do need to change, we do need to adapt because of this threat that we face, you know, and because of the competition that we face. So there is a degree of truth that we envy what they achieve, but the key there is not, that's not why anti-Semitism is, because anti-Semitism primarily arrives because of the hostility that they show towards us.
Yeah, it's a reaction to all of these things that we can see going on. I was just going to say, who do they think is going to do the work then? You know, if they don't have to do any work. I mean, the whole point is to work and create, and, you know, that's how you find fulfillment in your life. That's how you find contentment, is through working and creating and doing a good job, and then you're satisfied with what you've done, and you've created something for your community, whatever that is, if it's a bit part in whatever work you're doing, or whether it's, you know, designing something and you're quite high up in society, it's creating something for the benefit of your community. Whereas they don't look at it like that. They want the wages without having to do any work. It's just so opposite to the way white people are. It's fascinating. It's almost cartoonish, you know, this idea.
But it did, the phrase wages without work does put me in mind of two things. One being universal basic income, which obviously hasn't really been implemented anywhere yet, as far as I know, or maybe just one of two places, but it's still an idea that's being fought over. I'm against it. But also the phrase, which was originated by Aaron Bastani, who's like half Iranian, half British. I don't think there's any Jewish ancestry to him, but he's very much inspired by Jewish thinking. He's a communist, and he uses the phrase, and he promotes this as an idea, is a fully automated luxury communism, meaning all the work that needs, you know, that's essential and mundane and not enjoyable will be automated, ideally, in his system. And luxury meaning, you know, like there'll be such great rate of production that, you know, people will have loads of the things they want, even for pleasure, let alone need. And communism, as in this will all be produced by a sort of centralized state, I guess. You know, I think he's developed that idea out of Jewish thinking to some extent. But I, on the other end, I can see the appeal. I can see why that is an appealing idea to people. It's like the idea is that you're released to do what you want with your time. I mean, I want that as well, but I don't want it to be at the behest of the state, who might one day say, actually, wait a minute, you're a Nazi, so you're not having it. you're not having anything, and you've got nowhere else to go, so you're gonna die, basically. I mean, that's a rather extreme portrayal of it, but that is a danger. I think, yeah, he's thinking along the same lines, wages without work.
Well, you want time to be productive. You want to be productive. I mean, if he's saying you want wages without work, he means he doesn't want to be productive. He just wants to be paid. He just wants to consume. They're not creators. They're consumers. So they seek for ways that they can consume without creating, which is, you know, why there've always been middlemen, why there's always been merchants, usurers. I mean, they've pointed this out numerous times, that they're not creators, that they look down on menial work, particularly farm work. They look down on as being completely beneath them. You know, for a Jew to be a labourer or a farmer or something like that, they would be very frowned upon by the other Jews. And some of that works its way into our society now. And this idea, if you tell somebody young, you know, well, you don't want to work, you just want to get paid, they probably think that's a good idea, because they've been given this false idea of what our goals are as white people. They project these Jewish ideals onto us. And I've got a way here as well, which he's sort of talking about how we can get to the Jewish utopia. And he says, by overcoming that sickness of the mind, which thrives on the ground of self-assertion, untainted by reflective thought, mankind would develop from a set of opposing races to the species which, even in nature, is more than mere nature. So what he means there is Jews are the species which are more than mere nature. And he says to get to the Jewish mentality, you get rid of reflection. So he's saying you get rid of conscience and you just act on instinct, which is barbarism. Basically, it means you have no conscience, you have no reflection on your actions at all, and you just assert yourself, which means, you know, the destruction of the weakest. As a white man, you know, the big man is supposed to look out for the little man, not oppress the little man. And one of our great things about us is the golden rule, do unto others as you would have done to yourself. And we have a conscience. We reflect on things. It's just incredible to me. He calls that a sickness of the mind, to reflect on things, and we should want to be more like them. What are your thoughts on his philosophy here, Horace?
I always wonder when reading things like that, just how sincere the idea is. I think one thing Jewish like subversive philosophers are good at is mixing a degree of sincerity with things that they know to be absurd as they write them. So, I mean, like, can anyone seriously think that it's sick to be these things that he's inveighing against? I mean, like, surely you cannot. What it is just by calling it sick, that creates doubt about it. I cannot believe. I mean, even a man as subversive as this seriously thinks that our society without Jewish influences was sick. What it is is that. He sees something that he basically wants to take control of, or wants his group to take control of, and calling it sick is a way of doing that. And I've said about this before, like the Jewish, I don't know, well, the subversive way of arguing is pretextual. It's, you know, where you know the conclusion you want your listener to arrive at, and you just create whatever route takes them there, regardless of what's true. And I think this is an example of that. It's, you know, damning, casting damnation in whatever terms you think will work upon the things that you want to destroy.
Oh, it is by any means possible.
Very alien to my thinking, but once you recognise it, it's a very useful thing to recognise.
Well, they'll use anything to try and get to their goal. I think we should finish up with Kevin MacDonald, and he describes what they're basically trying to get to. The envisioned utopian society is one in which Judaism can continue as a cohesive group, but in which cohesive, nationalistic, corporate, Gentile groups, based on conformity to group norms, have been abolished as manifestations of psychopathology. And that's really what it all boils down to. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Horace. That's been a great episode. I believe you're going to have next week off, so we will have somebody else with us next week. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We look forward to seeing you again with more Truth Without Radio. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.